Let's try this again. Okay, today is November 4th, 2013, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Dave Klein on the first of our life history interviews, and we're here in Fairbanks, Alaska. So, Dave, hello.
Hi, Karen. Let's get going.
Let's get going. So, shall we start from the beginning?
Well, I can't. My memory of the birth is not good. But we can start close to that.
And so when was that? What's the date?
May 18, 1927.
All right. And your parents' names?
Norma Peverly, her maiden name.
How do you spell that?
P-E-V-E-R-L-E-Y, I think it is.
Okay.
Klein.
Okay.
And my father's name was Ferdinand.
Oh.
No middle name, Klein. K-L-E-I-N.
Okay. So where were you born?
I was born in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. And parents were living in a little suburb called Lunenburg, but I was born in the Fitchburg Hospital, and Dad had a job with Ivor Johnson Arms and Cycle. They made firearms and motorcycles and bicycles.
That's an interesting combination.
It is. He was a small tool machinist. He had interned. He was born in Brooklyn, New York, and grew up there, and then was working as an internist in Massachusetts in Cambridge when he met my mother.
You say an internist. He was an intern, or he was an internist, I think of as a medical doctor.
No, in those days, if you wanted to become a professional in any field, especially mechanics or carpentry or anything, finished carpentry or anything like that, you worked as an intern, which you got maybe room and board, but you didn't get a significant salary, but you were learning. And then as you learned, you gradually became more dependent on your salary, and the salary increased accordingly, et cetera. And your CV, if you had this, your chances of getting a job would be great.
Sort of like an apprentice back in the Middle Ages.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So your parents met in Cambridge?
That's true. And my mother's father was, he had sort of raised her. He had a butcher business in Cambridge, Mass, but he had lost his wife and his oldest daughter during an influenza episode. I think it was around 1918, and so he went ahead and was a single dad with one daughter, and he raised her there.
So, can you tell me a little bit more about your father's background? The name Ferdinand is somewhat unusual.
Well, my father's parents had immigrated from Switzerland, and they had lived in the French-speaking part, Neuchâtel, but his birth certificate shows that his parents were German, and they were from an area in Western Germany. I forget the name of it. And then he apparently emigrated, and maybe his parents did too, to Switzerland. And before he was, they must have when
as a
so
family.
He was born there, and then he married. He apparently was trained to be a small tool machinist, and apparently was involved in watchmaking. And then he married a French woman who was in Switzerland, but apparently had born in France and was never able to get enough information. My father died when he was 59, I think. And so I never got to know him very well as when I was an adult, partly because I was out of high school. I went right into the Navy during the Second World War, and he was working before that time. He was working 12-hour shifts and in Hartford, Connecticut, and we had time with him at mealtime. He was working night shift, and it was financially good for us after a depression that they had gone through, which we, as children, we never really understood that because we lived well up in Vermont, close to where my grandfather had a farm, and we had our own garden and some animals and chickens and what, and made it through the depression okay. But my dad was he was a jack of all trades, and he got work in the little Vermont village we lived in. He was the only person that could handle, if there was a problem with a power line, he could handle it. He was a lineman, and he was a good electrician, a good plumber, a good carpenter, and good machinist. And so he got by, we got by financially, but we were living as much off the land and gardening as what is possible.
Mm-hmm. So back to them being in Switzerland. You said he was a machinist and a watchmaker, and he married a Swiss woman. That was your dad, or that was your grandfather?
No, he married a French woman.
Married a French woman. That was your father. So he was married before he came to the U.S.?
So that would have been my grandmother on my father's side. So they were married.
Oh, that was, so it was your grandfather who married...
His wife was French.
Your grandfather's wife.
Yeah. I never met either of them. They were died before.
Okay.
Or whether they were my... No, they were... Yeah, they were my grandfather on my father and grandmother on my father's side, right.
But they had...
They had emigrated to Brooklyn, New York.
From Switzerland. But that grandfather was German, who moved to Switzerland and married a French woman.
Who was moved to Switzerland from France.
France. And then together they immigrated to Brooklyn. Do you know when they immigrated to Brooklyn? Or
I can get that information, but I dig it out. So I may make a note to that. But I can't pull it off the top of my head.
But it was...
My father...
When was your father born?
Good question. I can pull that out.
Well, let's go backwards. You said he died at age 59. Do you know what year he died? Approximately.
Yeah, 1946. Okay. No, 45. 1945.
So we can do some math.
I think it was 59.
Well, if he was 59 in 1945... He was born in 19. You're better at math. Mine is. That doesn't make sense. Oh, 18. No. I can't do math. 6. Oh, yeah. 1876. That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't.
Does it?
Well, let's see.
Anyway.
He died in 1945, and he was... No, it wasn't that early. It was... must have been 18...
Yeah, that would make, if anyway, somewhere in, they must have moved to Brooklyn.
In the 1880s, late 1880s, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay. Now that we've distracted ourselves.
But I can dig that stuff
That's
out.
Okay. But so you, so that grandfather who moved to Brooklyn from Switzerland, what did he do in Brooklyn? You never met them? Do you know what he did?
See, they were dead before I was born.
Okay.
And he had been a watchmaker in Switzerland, so it's anybody's guess what he did. And it might have been something related to that. And there was probably a demand for people with his training in, at that time in New York.
But your father never really talked about his parents.
Not much, no. In fact, my mother said that he was never talked very much about his parents or his... He had a sister, and he said that they didn't get along very well together and that he'd never kept track of her, and she'd gone west. And he didn't know whether she got married and had family or what. But...
Okay.
And, you know, the big, of course, question in my mind at times has been, since I didn't have a chance to really discuss these with my father, and he may not want to have not wanted to talk about them anyway, was why his parents left Germany and moved to Switzerland at the time that they did, and why his mother, who was French, left France and went to Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a lot going on, a lot of upheavals, especially in France. And she may have been unwelcome there, her family. I mean, she was, often people left because their family left.
Right.
So I don't know what... And my sister, older sister, 6 years older than I am, has made some attempts to try to get more background information and went to France with a French woman who she met in Florida where she lives and made a little progress. And my sister now claims she's going to spend more time with the genealogy of the Klein family.
Mm-hmm.
She's done that with her former husband's family, but she hasn't had time, and she's super busy volunteering and helping other people and frequently. But she's got a lot of grandkids and great grandkids too.
So you don't even know. You were saying you wonder why they moved to Switzerland. Well, then the next question is, well, why did they move to Brooklyn?
But except that a lot of people that came to the United States through New York in that era sometimes came via Switzerland because Switzerland was a sort of a neutral place and they may have felt unwelcome in their countries or whatever.
Yeah, why did they choose to leave Switzerland? Because we don't know that either.
Well, Switzerland is a difficult place to stay because it's hard to... a different country, but it's there aren't that many jobs frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Or there may be jobs, but they're only for skilled people. And Switzerland was if you're... If you left because of some problems with your philosophy or political leanings or religious leanings, and you went to Switzerland, they weren't a problem, but to be absorbed into the Swiss culture was a more difficult thing.
Hmm.
And true of any, I mean, this has been the case right up through modern times when, you know, after the Second World War, Switzerland was a stepping stone. It was one place where people from the communist zone or during the early stages of Nazism, that people could go there and they may have been felt oppressed or even threatened if they stayed where they were, or but also for their belief system, if they were, for example, so many Jews went to Switzerland, but there were so many people from other faiths, and they realized that if they'd been politically active, and plus they didn't have as many options politically, because frequently the only options were fascism or Nazism, mm-hmm. which was fascism, or communism.
Right.
Yeah, it was communism or fascism. And that wasn't necessarily a solution for a lot of people, and understandably, and the United States was such an attractive place because of our open society where we welcomed immigrants and would supposedly it was a melting pot and provided tolerance and freedom of expression of your own views, mm-hmm. as long as it were done through a democratic process.
Right. And I've asked you this before, the name Klein, for many people that's associated as a Jewish name, but you don't consider that you have a Jewish family. Or do you?
Well, there's no indication directly from my youth that in relationship to my father. My father was, my mother was moderately religious, and so she attended when I was growing up in Connecticut, and she wanted us kids to go to Sunday school in a Congregationalist church, a liberal Protestant church, and we lived in Vermont. I remember that we stayed in, we rented for a period a little small home, and the rental was cheap during the Depression, and it was a parsonage for the Methodist Church. But family thought the Methodist Church was too conservative. And my father was tolerant of religious beliefs, but he didn't believe in organized churches. And I assume that he had leanings towards Christianity, but I think he was agnostic. He belonged to the Masons, which usually requires acknowledgement of a god, but not a specific faith. But he was, you know, a Boy Scout a leader, and but he didn't like organized churches, and so he's more like the old school early American leaders, like George Washington, for example. He was a deist, probably, but he was even questioned that. And I guess you could say Thomas Jefferson was in a similar category. But some of these are my assumptions based upon not knowing what I grew up with.
Right. But your father never gave any indication that there was a Jewish background, or that's why they had
not
left.
Not directly. He was pretty knowledgeable. He had a high school education, but he was extremely well read. He considered himself with an engineer's training. He was impressed by advances due to engineering and technology, bridge building, but also steam engines and beginning of the internal combustion engine, et cetera, et cetera. And he understood this very well and was well read. And he had also studied a lot of things that related to it, like civil engineering and mapping and surveying and things of that nature. They had a very broad interest, and I was impressed in later years when I went through some old books of his, and there was some notes he had made when he was reading Haeckel's book on evolution, in which Haeckel was coined the term ecology, and he had made note of all of this, and he was certainly believed in evolution, and he would kid my mom at times, and when at the dinner table we'd be talking about something, and he would, you know, explain things in an evolutionary context, and see, you know, he would joke with her about this, and they were both tolerant of the other's understandings, and got by fine. But he didn't. He felt that we should be free to make our own judgment as to whether we wanted to continue with the Sunday school after, I think it was 10 or 11 years of age. Then it was our decision, not Mom's. She might have a recommendation, but it was clearly stated, and they both agreed to that. But he was not an active church member. He went there on special occasions, mainly for cultural reasons, family reasons.
So did you continue Sunday school after you were given a choice?
No, I didn't. But at the same time, I was connected to the church to some extent because we had a Boy Scout troop that met there. And then there was a young people's organization and a social kind of thing. And I did sort of just join that. And in fact, then there was the preacher at that time was a real intellectual, a young guy about 30, and he related very well to young people. And maybe one of my attractions for that was that it was during the Second World War, and I was in high school, and I knew I was going to be drafted when I get out of high school. I would be 18 and draft age, and there was most of the members, there weren't very many boys my age or a little older, because they were already gone off to the military. So there were a lot of young women. And I got a lot of attention because I think I was elected president of that organization. But it was, as far as I was concerned, it was a real social organization. Enjoyed it.
Did it have a name, that group?
It was like most churches, Protestant churches, have something like that. A youth group or something like that.
Yeah.
But they did things like we put on their plays, and we'd do evening played ping pong, and we'd sometimes do outings on the weekend and to play softball or picnics, and then there was a problem. When the church deacons, I guess, felt that they approved of all this and the ministers' good relations with the young people, but then they thought that we all should be plan to join the church. But in order to join the church, you had to go to some training. Well, this was borderline for me, but I figured I'll go through it, and it was a minister that did the training, and he sort of went through the basics at what we had to presumably believe, but he was very understanding. He couldn't explain things, and when we asked him difficult questions like, you know, if there's this trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Well, how? Who's the real God there? And are there? What about the devil? Do we? Mostly, this church didn't buy into the devil, but other churches, Protestant churches, did. More fundamental. Well, that must be a God then, if it's not under control of the one God. So there must be multiple gods, like the Romans, early Romans, and the Greeks had. And of course, later on, I began to realize, yeah, the Judaism made a real effort to try to avoid the multiple gods, but they also had to make some concessions, and this Trinity seemed to be like the minister explained all these things in a pretty good way. He was well informed. He had good training, and he said, "Well, some of these questions don't feel like you have to understand them." He says, "I don't still, and I don't expect that you should, just for the sake of joining the church." So I never realized whether I actually joined the church or not. And a few years after I had graduated and gone into the Navy, and then I never really went to the church after that, and didn't feel I needed to for any specific reason. And then I heard that the minister had felt it was time for him to resign, and he went back to start doing more theological studies. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of respect for him, because he was a man that he felt he couldn't find all the answers in the Bible or understanding of the faith unless you really went into it. And he would give it a try. And I don't know whether he ever stuck to it or not in the long run. But he was such an open-minded guy, and he understood us so well that it was a nice part of my life to have that experience with him, even though I was never really convinced I wanted to join the church.
Yeah. And now, I didn't ask you about your siblings. You have a sister, you mentioned.
And a brother. And my sister is 6 years older than I am.
And her name is?
Elizabeth Pryor, a married name.
P-R-Y-O-R?
P-R-I-O-R.
Oh, okay.
And my brother, who is 2 years older than I am, is Richard Arthur Klein.
Okay. And so, tell me a little bit. Oh, you mentioned that your parents met in Cambridge, but what was your mother doing? Was she working with her in the butcher shop, or?
She had a couple of jobs there, and I'm not sure exactly which one she had at the time she and my father started getting together. But one job was she was trained. She had some training. She went to a special school beyond high school to get clerical and accounting experience, so women with that kind of training could stand a chance of getting jobs. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was foresightful in that regard. But he also, I think she had some artistic abilities, and I think she had a little bit of art training, but she got one of the jobs she got while she was still living in Cambridge, and before she was married, that was working for a company that produced fine china for dining and what, and very high quality stuff with a lot of floral designs. And so she was employed on painting these floral designs, usually from photographs or pictures or paintings, and it was mainly the design that she was doing and working with was it was virtually all flowers, plants, fruit, and foliage like apples for cider pouring and small glasses. And for so most of this was sold to wealthy people, and so it was pretty expensive stuff. After the painting, it was fired then, so it was very permanent. I have a few of her pieces, and my sister has several of them, and it's beautiful stuff.
Do you know the name of the company?
I don't. Maybe I can check. There's one or two items here.
Okay, we'll look later.
We can probably get down, get that. And my sister probably can provide more.
So how did your parents, what's the story of how your parents met?
I really don't know that exactly. My sister may have more of that. I have copies of a couple of my mom's diary, but it was mainly not regular. And I know that sometimes would rent a rowboat in Boston Harbor and go out and fish out in the bay. Hmm. And he liked to fish a lot. He was an ardent fisherman, and he liked to fly fish and stream fish and lake fish, and he was also a hunter. But when he was courting her, they would go out there, and she commented, I remember, that she tended to get seasick if it was wave action, sitting out there and the boat was rocking. But she could handle that if she had a book to read, which she could do that. She enjoyed doing it, though, enjoying being out there. And later in life, she did enjoy fishing herself. And and they both loved that, getting out on the water. They were both people that loved to be close to the environment, the natural environment, or close to the soil that they could get their hands in and do some gardening. Both of them did, and having animals. And my mother always had lots of houseplants, and when we lived in Vermont and Connecticut, she had a big flower garden, but also she would work in vegetable gardens, but the rest of us would do a lot of helping with the vegetable gardens, and my dad and then my grandfather was living with us too after his wife had died, and he'd sold off the farm in Vermont. He lived with us, and he took over responsibility. He loved gardening, and he took over responsibility for the vegetable garden. But she did the flower gardens, and she was great at arranging flowers. She had a real sense of aesthetic sense for displaying them and appreciating flowers and loved wildflowers. And she had a big impact on me, I think, in this regard. And in the springtime, when the wildflowers were starting to come out, and on a Sunday she'd say, "Well, who wants to go walk with me? And we maybe see some wildflowers." And we'd go through the woods and the fields, and I was usually always immediately saying, "Yeah, I would." And so I learned a lot from her, and became fascinated with learning the wildflowers and gardening. And she had a big influence on me in terms of plants and even houseplants. You know, she taught me how to start gloxinias and things. She liked gloxinias and how to root them and how to be patient.
Did you learn other things from her? Were you influenced by her in other ways besides the...
I was influenced by her and my father tremendously, and some of which I didn't appreciate so much at the time, but I have, and especially as I get older, I realize, they had a big impact. And she certainly supported my interests and my interest in aesthetics and landscaping and art. And convinced my father that he had a good job by then, but had bought a old house and land, and we didn't have surplus money. It was recovering from the Depression, and they agreed to, take a few art lessons, which was okay, but I was already doing some nice stuff, but I was very slow, meticulous. The teacher I had was a young woman who, would give you this assignment. You have 3 minutes to make big freehand things with different colored crayons or whatever it was. And this was not my way of doing things. After, I think, 2 lessons, I told my mother, this woman she doesn't understand me at all. And I didn't understand what she was trying to do. And she was a nice young woman, but I thought that was a waste of money because she was just telling me I was doing everything wrong.
And how old about were you?
I think it was about maybe 9, about that age. 8, yeah. Maybe. I was tended to be a rather shy guy. Maybe if I'd been more outspoken, she might have adapted. But I basically felt that she was the wrong person, that it would have been a different person that might have worked. And I've certainly appreciated that my mom and dad were willing to pay for some special lessons, which those kind of things were. They did a little bit of that for violin for my sister, and my brother didn't get any of that kind of help, but he didn't show an interest. He was more interested in mechanical things.
Mm-hmm. So what other ways did your parents influence you?
Well, my father was such a handyman, and both my brother and I wanted to be, he was a terrific role model, and he was terrific. We all loved him and appreciated the time we had with him. Mm-hmm. And it was especially during the war when he was working these long shifts, and it was good financially because he'd get extra pay for working long and night, and it was a war effort, and he didn't have much time to be with us. Like he was working night shifts, so we'd have dinner with him, and that's the only time we'd see him, because he'd be sleeping during the day when we went off to school, and then he'd have to get up and have dinner and then go to work afterwards. But those dinners were all important, that the whole family could be there, and all of us had different things. My siblings, and we were different in different age, but we had being part of that was important for me, and I'm sure it was for my two siblings. And so we were really intact, very intact family that was benefiting from wonderful parents who were intelligent and taught us a lot. My mom was, and my dad were also, they'd play games with us, and a lot of different kind of card games we'd play. And, we realized that they were both top-notch competitors, and that they enjoyed playing together, and they enjoyed learned cribbage from my dad, and solitaire, dual solitaire with my mom, and yeah, you had to think fast, and see, they encouraged all of that, and it was fun, and it was good times for sure. And then, yeah, all of that.
So I'm going to take us back a little bit, because you were born in Massachusetts, and now you're talking about Vermont, and then you end up in Connecticut. So what happened?
We were born in Massachusetts, and that's where my father was working for Ivor Johnson Arms and Cycle. And then the Depression hit hard, and looked like, you know, he had a good future, but then they cut back, and the Ivor Johnson virtually folded. They got rid of the virtually everything except the firearms, mm-hmm. and then recovered a little during the war, but they didn't survive too well. So that's when the family moved to Vermont. I think it was partly survival. And there we could get a rent a place with land and have a garden and have a few animals. And my dad could get part-time jobs because he is so skilled in different things. And he, you know, the community didn't have, like in a city, if they needed some electrical work done, he was available.
What was the name of the town in Vermont?
Heartland. Heartland.
H-A-R?
H-A-R-T-L-A-N-D.
Okay.
And it's on the Connecticut River, north of, almost opposite Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. But it's a small community with, had one store and one gas station, post office, and a tiny town hall, which was brick and classic and still standing there. Mm-hmm. And a four-room school where I went to first and second grade. So there was, in first and second grade, it was the same teacher in one room. And you know, there were two grades per room.
Mm-hmm. And so did your dad lose his job? Was he fired? Because they downsized, or he just left before he
died? I think they just laid off people and no guarantee that they would be employed, and that was happening across the country. So, he went to Vermont, and where felt it, and it was my grandfather, my mother's father, had remarried and had a small farm that was sort of referred to as a subsistence farm. He had six or eight milking cows, a team of horses, cut his own hay and raised his own silage for the cows, and had a big garden and had a big apple orchard and a sugar bush. He made maple syrup, and he loved having a small farm like that. He loved the diversity and being his own boss, and they normally didn't have to hire any help. He did most of it himself. And his wife, his second marriage, was to a woman who was a widow, and she was a good, from our perspective, a nice step-grandmother, because she was just warm to all of us and friendly and a good cook, and fit well within that setting.
Did you think of her as a step-grandma, or she was just grandma? Because you didn't know the first one.
Well, but we were told, yeah. And definitely thought of her as a substitute grandma, mm-hmm. who was, as far as we were concerned, we didn't have a real grandma.
Right.
So, on my father's side, they were all gone. I never knew them, and so we had her and her grandfather, and we thought of her as a grandmother. Yeah.
So the town, Heartland, where you went, was near your grandfather's farm?
It was only about 3 or 4 miles away.
So that's why you went there.
I think that was the reason. largely the reason. But it was also the place where they could get by and not be real dependent upon the grandfather, but at least it was an emergency fallback. If occasionally, you know, if we went out there, we always came back with great quantities of apples and some meat, maybe, I think he gave us calves a couple of times. We raised them for veal.
Oh.
And we had a lot of chickens and some geese that we raised for eggs and for eating purposes. But that was in this village that was right at the, you know, within walking distance of the school. We had this old, we rented this old farm building which had a barn, and so that we could have these other animals in the garden there. And there was kind of an aging orchard, but we had plenty of things like apples and stuff, and got by very well. We tapped some of our own sugar trees and made some of our own syrup, but when we'd go out to during sugaring time at my grandfather's farm, then that, you know, that was really fun for us kids, because he had to use a horse and a little sled and haul the buckets, a big wooden container on the sled, and that he had emptied the sap in, and then grandmother would be boiling down in a big special shed where the steam would be coming out, and maintain the fire with hardwoods that you harvested from the land for fuel, and then she'd boil down some of it, the maple syrup, so that it would get thick, and then just take a ladle and throw it out on the snow, and it would turn to candy. And that was wonderful.
I forgot to ask you that grandfather's name.
Richard Peverly.
And then his first wife died, who you didn't know, but this woman he married, the grandmother, what was her first name?
I have that upstairs.
She's just grandma.
Right. I knew what it was at one time, but I forgot.
Okay.
It's upstairs.
We can fill that in.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like, so you must have been a small boy at this point in Vermont during the Depression.
Yeah, we moved there when I was about a year after I was born.
Oh, so 1928.
So then from 2 through to end of second grade, that would be 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Then we moved to Connecticut.
Okay. And so why did you...
Okay, then we moved to Connecticut because all this time my father was trying to find a job, you know, a full-time job. And so he found a job in Hartford, Connecticut with the company that was founded, I think, to make Sikorsky helicopter parts. Mm-hmm. And that was, 1930 what? I was born in 27, and then... 8 years, 35, so that was about 36. And so just when helicopters, Sikorsky had developed a helicopter that was functional, and there were a lot of efforts that hadn't been successful. And so my father got a good job there as a machinist, and then stayed there and worked his way up, and... Then during the Second World War, that's when he was, they were very important, and he would work these long shifts because everybody did, and for the war effort. And then he was supervise a big section of the workers, the machinists, that he had been when he started out.
Yeah, well, he'd been there long enough, he moved up to supervisor.
Yeah, but he was good because they put him in charge fairly early on. Mm-hmm. And he appreciated that. However, he had some problems because he was, eventually some of these workers were became unionized, and I think he was too. And he was in support of that, of unionization, and so they got improvement in mainly salaries and for the work they were doing. But then when he became manager, he could no longer be part of the union.
Oh.
So then
he
had to
become part of management.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if then he and my mother told me this, that he was pretty unhappy because he was really on the side of the workers, but he couldn't be proactive. He had to maintain a very low profile in these conflicts, and that hurt him because his loyalty was to the workers. And this is always a problem, I'm sure, in other situations. But he survived, and they went on producing helicopter parts.
Well, certainly during the World War II, producing helicopter parts was quite important.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and I can see why he worked long. They were busy company.
And in the interests of, from the standpoint of companies that were producing these essential parts, I mean, they were making big money, but at the same time, you tend to put the focus on you're supporting the war effort and let's get pump this stuff out and the workers volunteer to work harder, et cetera, et cetera. And they had taken advantage of somewhat, even if it's not deliberate. And then that's a strike in order to, well, we should be getting more pay for this. And of course, in other industries, it was much worse when there were more women learning these skills and working in machine shops and what. And, they got all of these awards and everything from the government, the president, helping the war effort. But their salaries frequently were so minuscule.
Yeah.
Even though they were far better than they had been for any woman. And there were opportunities where women could do these things and be trained to do them just as well as the men, like Maggie the Riveter and these kind of things. Building aircraft and pumping them out so fast. And it was an era of change, but there's always that problem in an era of change that things are slow in catching up.
Well, you're right. They often don't recognize in all that the recognition of women that they don't really tell you, they didn't get paid as much as the men.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, you're right, there were a lot of women in that industry, how come your father was able to stay home and work and he wasn't in the military?
Well, partly because he was an essential job, but also he had, in that time, they didn't take a father away and leave the family with kids and on their own.
Oh.
In those days, I mean, maybe if you're just freshly married and have one child, that would be one thing. It was all important. A lot of people stayed out of the military because they were considered essential for their family. A lot of men were physically capable and didn't met all of the physical requirements. I mean, that was one thing that was admirable about the United States, where other countries might have said, well, we will compensate the women and we'll put them in a group living or something like that. Well, that wasn't realistic. Farming, people involved in farming, got out of the military because it was so important. The essential jobs were important.
Right. And you're right, the idea of leaving Your mother, a single woman with three children, how would she have been able to support herself in that era? It would have been difficult.
And that there was so much emphasis on doing. My father was before the Second World War, was a pacifist. Although he didn't, as kids, we didn't get exposed to that very much because there was no need to it. Mm-hmm. He was a pacifist, tolerant of other belief systems, and racially tolerant. Those two, in New England and Connecticut, there wasn't a lot of racial tolerance, wasn't a big issue, but we knew of the history of the slavery of the United States, and we knew of, in the case of Jews, oppression of Jews, and there was some of that in the United States. And then when, during the war and Nazism, my father was quite aware of what was going on, and he could keep in touch with any new people through his work that had relatives in Europe. And so he was not very supportive. He was certainly a conservative, fiscal conservative Republican of the old school, very much supportive of the environment and protection of the environment. But when during the war and Roosevelt was president and taking drastic steps to get out of the depression and then also to lead our country during a war, then he was very supportive of the war effort and the need to support our government. So he was very understanding. He was a good citizen in terms of being well informed, and I can say, we all of us and my mom as well, benefited from his feeling that you don't just ignore, if things are going well, you don't just ignore the government. You have to. He understood the depression and what it was caused, and he wanted to see the country revive and get back economically in good shape. And he was happy that when he could get a job and things would go well. But he was very well read on. And I remember just before the Second World War and during it, that subsistence living he was fascinated by it. Hmm. And I'd never been able to find, I went looked for it one time, a publication that was put out, was it Sunset publication in California? Mm-hmm. That I'm pretty sure it was Sunset. They had this one edition that emphasized, home gardens. Mm-hmm. and self-sufficiency and with instructions how to proceed. Mm-hmm. And he explained about that, and the book was around for a while, and it was fascinating. And he was into doing it right in terms of gardening. And we had this problem in Connecticut with pretty good soils, but you'd get a hard pan layer. And when soils were used over a period of time, and it was related to some of the leaching of pod salts, and this hard pan layer, and then that it was hard for the roots to get down where there were still nutrients below, and you had a shallow, workable soil. And what was needed was some deep plowing periodically, like once in 5 years or so. And he did a lot of this on small vegetation plots by hand, and then would fertilize it with, stir the soil up and put in compost. And the compost was also included chicken manure, which we had chickens. And my brother and I had that not very enjoyable job of cleaning out the chicken sheds in the springtime with all this accumulation. And that went into this. And we understood it. He explained the whole thing. And it wasn't just, you guys have to do this, period. You know, this is why we're doing it. And it was complicated. He explained that to us. And so we understood, and we didn't like the work. And I would frequently negotiate with my brother, because he hated it worse than I did. he didn't like to have the job of watering the chickens and feeding them daily and gathering the eggs. That's the part that I liked. And so I said, well, I'll do it for, you know, most of the time, but you have to take over major responsibility for the cleaning. And I'd give him a hand, because it was, to take it, do it by yourself, it was psychologically depressing, because there's so much to do, so messy.
You must have smelled, too.
Oh, yeah. You get used to the smell after a while, but when you went in the house, they didn't. They knew you'd been out there. Or if you went, didn't change your clothes before you went to school.
Oh, God. Well, it sounds like you got the better end of the deal. Your brother, you
he
just
was
had to
usually,
feed and water them.
He was usually better than I was at wrangling something so that he got out of it. But in this case, you know, I had such good bait that saying, well, I'll do these things that you don't do, and I'll do it for a long period of time. Take that over. And as long as you do this. And we did this sometimes with shoveling snow in the driveway. And
so what would you swap out for shoveling snow?
I don't recall. That might have been the timing when it was done, because he might have argued that he was going to do something with his buddy, and that if Dad came home and it wasn't done, then he would get, and he really wanted to do it badly, and so would I do his share. So I did it sometimes that way. He might have done it for me that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a good guy. He was, as a big brother, he took advantage of me a lot of time, but on the other hand, I get away with quite a bit, too.
It sounds like you got him back with the chickens.
Yeah.
I lost track of where we were. We're talking about the chickens. So all this, you're talking about your father and what he was like. So tell me about a little bit more about your mother. You said she was artistic and...
She was... father was tall... We got our height, all my siblings and I I'm 6, I forget what I was, 6'2", I think, and my brother was like about 6'3", and my sister was about 5'10½" or 11", something.
So you're all tall.
All tall and slender, like him, and... Mom was slender, but pretty short. I forgot, 5'5", maybe, or 4, but I'm not sure exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she, when we got older, it was obvious. You know, he was a small one, family. But She was just very kind, loving, understanding. I think that would be a good one. And was good at, since he had a lot of the time with us, especially when we were preteen and teens, when Dad wasn't around us as much, things like, you know, why do you, table manners and eating properly. Well, since my dad had diabetes that came on at about age 30, and it probably was some genetic type similar to youth onset, because he was not obese and he was very active. But fortunately, insulin had been discovered, and so he was a standard that every morning he would had to boil his needles and syringes, and he'd give himself a required shot depending upon the work he was doing and estimating, and the dosage in relationship to what he's eating. And then Mom learned along with him from the doctor, you know, what kind of diet he should have to help as much as possible. And he was certainly physically active, and there wasn't any need to emphasize that. But at first, you know, it was the problem with that kind of treatment was that they didn't, the main problem was maintaining a reasonable balance of a blood sugar level. Mm-hmm. And if it got too high, then you had problems and you could go into a coma, but also it was detrimental because their liver was being damaged, if that was the case, in kidneys, as well as could affect your eyesight, etc. And so he had, you know, when he went to work, he always had something standby. If he felt weak, he could eat a candy bar, something, but it didn't take too much sugar. And so he'd like sweets and desserts, and so Mom cooked things differently, and she made a cake for him with a nice frosting. He would barter. He wouldn't eat his frosting, and he'd barter that to us kids, not so much barter it, but try to divide it fairly. And but we lived and ate healthily because we had a garden and chickens and what, and had some understanding. But in those days, of course, you didn't go to the supermarket and buy the greens and fresh vegetables in the wintertime. You just didn't eat those things. But we had things in the root cellar, carrots and beets and things, and a lot of things were canned, the green beans canned, and we had a lot of things. And even before freezing was an option, and then you could start, but that wasn't until toward the end of the Second World War that freezing was an option. And early on, we didn't even have a fridge. We had an ice chest. Mm-hmm. With icemen bringing ice by every once a week or something.
Oh, a block of ice would last that long?
You tried to have a big enough place to put it in the refrigerator at the top, and that would keep things cool. Of course, in wintertime, you didn't need so much because you could put a box outside and put things in that.
Right.
And a lot of things you didn't, when you're having a lot of canned food and stuff, you didn't need it for, if you meat, if it was just cool, it was not a big deal. And we're going to have a chicken, Grandpa would go out and butcher it, or my dad would butcher it. They use different techniques.
What were their techniques?
Well, my father was good at taking the, we had a basement where the furnace and he'd would get a chicken to be slaughtered and bring it in and tie the feet together and tie the wings back, hang it from the feet, I think, in a rafter in the basement, and then he would pith it.
What does that mean?
You have to, a special way, you go up through the beak with a very sharp knife into the brain. Ooh. And if it's done properly, that you pith it and the feathers relax.
The wings relax, you mean? Or
the wings, so you're usually holding the wings back. Oh. One person, or he would, or you could tie them back so they won't flap. But if you, and of course, when they're upside down, they would try to flap in what. But this way, you just grab the head, pull it down, and stick this up there. You used to do that things and when I was in college in the lab to working with chickens. We did some autopsies on chickens and learned how to capenize chickens. You have to operate on them, but mm-hmm. Sometimes you just learn how to kill them too. And with killing them was this pithing. It's very tricky because you got to hit this one little spot and let's do it just right. And Dad was just good at that. And then when the feathers relax, the animal's dead. And then you can bleed them. And then you can pull off most of the feathers while they're still hanging there. They don't stick. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you kill them by chopping the head off or something, which my grandfather preferred, then you often the feathers wouldn't come out very well, and you'd have to dip them into scalding water after they were dead, and then you could pull the feathers out.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it has something to do with these muscles that hold the feathers in place and cause, you know, they can expand the feathers and bring them down like hair on your body in relationship to cold or whatever. So, or displaying and big rooster displaying.
Uh-huh.
So, and there was an interesting session. I remember I was very attracted to my grandfather. After his wife had died and he sold the farm in Vermont, we were down in Connecticut and we had this house that had room and big garden, and so he was invited down. My mom invited him down to stay with us, and he was still in pretty good health then. I don't know how old he was then. He probably was about 68 or 70, and he came down and he took over the gardening and a little bit he would handle any other things that needed being done. But he just loved it. And I used to hang out with him and help him because there had been a hurricane, one of the rare ones that came up through New England a year before when we lived in Hartford. And so there were a lot of, in this place that we bought, had a big woodlot and there were a lot of trees, big oaks and down. And we had a big wood-fired furnace that heated the house, mm-hmm. and it was in the basement. And so he just took over salvaging all this wood, with cutting it by hand with a big saws. Sometimes us kids would go out after school, and he would show us how to hold on to one end of a big saw and saw through these huge trunks, and then he would split all those things up, and I just loved to do all that kind of work. And at any rate, one time my mom wanted to have chicken for Sunday dinner, and there was one big rooster. They thought time for him to go. So the grandpa said, "Okay, I'll do it, and I'll take care of it for you." He said, I forget what they called me then, Davy, I think. Davy might want to watch it. She said, "I don't want to watch it." And he said, "We'll do it behind the woodshed." So I went out there and the rooster and got it down there and took the axe and and dropped it, you know, and the thing runs around for a little while.
With its head cut off?
Yeah. She didn't want to see that. She didn't quite approve of him showing me, but she knew what it was like.
Oh, so you went and watched?
Oh, for sure. Oh. I wanted to see it.
Oh, but your mom didn't want to see it.
Yeah. She didn't want to see it. Yet, be sure I can't see it from the kitchen window. But we enjoyed enjoyed it for dinner.
So did you end up then butchering chickens since you learned so well how to do it?
Yeah, but I got into trouble one time. I learned how to do it, and I did a few, but not much. When I was working at the experimental farm, they had some chickens, and the animal husbandryman there was on the faculty here and head of the animals at the farm. Really a nice guy, and I was working part-time. He sort of adopted me, and he wanted me to go into agriculture. And I told him I was so committed to wildlife now that I was interested in agriculture. And I took agriculture courses, several of them, because I was really interested. But they had some chickens. and he told this story. I wasn't involved in this one. But he told this story about pithing a chicken, and he brought this chicken home. He was a Mormon, and he was only been here for, it had been a couple of years, and his wife was a young housewife, and they just had one baby or something. And they were both just terrific people, but so she wasn't used to farm background, apparently. And so he brought this, and they were living in campus housing, one of these old houses down mm-hmm. there where they still a few left. And he brought this chicken home alive, and he says, "We're going to have it, and you can help me." And so he wasn't too excited about this. And they had a screen door from the garage into the house so the mosquitoes wouldn't get in the house. And they were doing it because of the mosquitoes. They were doing it in the kitchen right by that door. And she said, "I want you to hold the chicken and the wings back so it doesn't flap, and I'm going to pith it." And so her husband pipped this thing. And when the thing relaxed, she just fainted, fell through the screen door. Fortunately, she didn't get hurt.
Yeah.
Into the garage.
But so, did you butcher chickens as a kid then?
Yeah. I did that, yeah.
And which method did you use? Your grandfather's?
I did the pithing.
You did the pithing.
I did the pithing, yeah. I thought that was a good way. But then I got into trouble once when I went with my partner, Heather McIntyre, to visit her son and wife who were starting to try to farm in Wisconsin. And they had a garden, and they weren't big on, they were mostly vegetarian. They weren't big on killing animals, but they knew they would probably get into it. And they were in a rural area, and we stayed with them, and they came home. They had two chickens, and someone, their friends who were about like them, had got these as chicks and raised them, and they didn't want to kill them, but mm-hmm. they were ready to be eaten, and so they gave them to them. So they had these, and so then Heather said, she told them that I know how to pith a chicken, and makes it easier. How do you kill a chicken? They didn't want to kill a chicken, but how do you do it? And we want to eat it. And so I took it out and hung it on a tree, and I tried to remember everything just right. I didn't get it. No, it didn't work. It was flapping like mad. No, the blood just started to come out. It took me too long to do it. And they decided, they didn't think they wanted to have chickens after all.
It does sound quite horrible to think about.
But it's really quick and humane.
Yeah.
To do it, kill them so quickly.
Yeah. It does seem a little, if you do it right, it does seem a little more humane than cutting the head off.
It was when I was working at the experimental farm, they were doing an experiment with pigs, and they had a lot of young pigs. And when they got about so big, and just good for ready to slaughter, then they, I was working mainly with the the dairymen, they said, well, we're going to need your help, as well as the dairymen, when we're slaughtering. And they had a little slaughterhouse there, and I was interested in getting involved in slaughtering and seeing how you do it. And so I said, yeah, that's fine. I'd like to learn. One of the things I learned is that, they drive some of these pigs up a ramp to the end of the slaughterhouse. Just before they got in there, you'd go out and it'd get narrowed down, and you'd get a gate so they couldn't run back. And then one guy would grab it and be squealing a bit, and try to hold it steady. And they used a small sledge, mm-hmm. and you hit them right in the forehead.
You hit the pig right in the forehead?
Yeah, right in the forehead, and it knocks them out. And then you immediately cut their throat and let them bleed. And then you bring them in the slaughter shed, and they have a trough there so that you can wash everything down and catch it out as it comes out, all of the entrails and stuff, so you don't just throw it out. and then you add this boiling water, and you scald them, scrape all the hair off and mm-hmm. everything, and then butcher them. And I learned all this, how to butcher, and then we went through each day. They had about over 100 pigs, and each day we go through about 30, and it was hard work, but it was so efficient. And but towards the end, there were only, they say, a dozen pigs left, and the pigs were wary, because then they couldn't get them to, you couldn't drive them. They would go run away, because they
knew what was up.
They must have known what was up, because they were able to escape up until that time. So then they had to one of the guys used a rifle with a scope, and it'd shoot the pig, and then we'd rush out there and pick it up and bring it in and put it there, and they finally get all the rest of it. Well, then, sometime later, the animal husbandman, this Lynn Hollis, the guy, he said, old dairy cow had stopped milking, and she wouldn't breed. They couldn't get her to breed, so mm-hmm. we're going to have to slaughter her. So I said, yeah, there was just the two of us going to do the butchering on this. And so he said, I want you to do the, I'll be holding it, and I'll show you how to handle it. And then he had a special pistol for killing animals. And so it had a short barrel, and you hold it right up against the spot on the head. And he said, I think he was holding it, and he had me, I was going to do the shooting. But I don't really remember that. Maybe I think I was holding the halter, and the cow was totally docile. I was just standing there, and didn't have a clue what was going to happen to it. And so then I remember him making a little cross in the hair, and that's where you have to hit it. And I don't know whether it was me holding the pistol or him. And he put that right up there, or I did put it right up there, just exactly as I said, pulled the trigger, and the cow didn't even flinch. He took it away, and yeah, there was a hole. Well, it didn't go through the skull, apparently. And so then he got a little panicky. And so he did it a second time, and it still, the cow didn't go down. But the cow wasn't unruly then. It was like you could just hit it on the head because it was misbehaving or something. So then he had enough. He went into the shed and got a sledgehammer. and he made that cross again. And he wanted me to hold it really steady. hit in that spot, and he went right down. You know, and everything went fine. The old-fashioned way was a better way.
Poor cow.
No, I mean, that's better than, what, just putting it in a grinder without killing it?
No. No, but all those pigs, you said they had the pigs for research purposes? And then they had, then they were done with the research, so they had to get, had to slaughter them.
Well, then they, yeah, at the end of the study, it was a growth study with some kind of food. I think they were trying to feed crab waste from canneries in the coast, mm-hmm. mixing with other things and seeing how the growth was. Well, it was a good, well-designed study, and they all had to be weighed too, right away. That was one of the first things you did. And both whole as well as the carcass. And so it was a good study. And then I think they announced in the paper that you could buy half or whole pig carcass after it was slaughtered and cooled for a good rate. So people could come out and buy them.
Yeah, that's good. So I was going to have you tell me a little bit. I know. When your grandfather moved in with you in Connecticut, do you have a sense of how old you were?
Well, I'd have to check on that. But I think he was either late 60s or 70.
No,
maybe.
But how old you were?
So I was, I would have been probably... I'd have to. That was in Connecticut, and I had to be in sixth and seventh grade.
Okay.
Or maybe even freshman, but I think, and I forget when he died, and what he died of, but it was probably an unknown kind of cancer or something like that.
But
that
do you know how old you were when he died? Like you were in high school, or you were in?
I have to go and look.
Navy.
I can check on that.
Because the reason I was asking how old you were, because I have this sense from you that you had a really strong attachment to him. He meant a lot to you.
Especially once I got into high school, I don't know whether he was still there or still alive, or I'm pretty sure he had died, because it seemed to me he went. He went somewhere else when he got sick. He might have gone back to Syracuse, where he had other relations, cousins or something, and he might have been gone back there. My memory sort of indicates that, and that's where my mom was born, in Syracuse.
Oh, okay.
And they were from England via, from America via the English. They've immigrated first, a family, to Canada for a generation or two, and then from Canada to upstate New York and adjacent Vermont.
And I didn't ask you, did either of your parents, did they have siblings? Did your mother have brothers and sisters?
My mother, her mother was, and her older sister died in the influenza.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yes, right. So she was an only child.
She was left as a sole child, right.
Right. And then your father?
He had a sister, and my mom said he didn't get along very well with his sister when.
Oh, that's right. She moved west. That's right.
West, we think.
Okay, but so you didn't have aunts and uncles around when you were growing up.
We had a great uncle and great aunt. I guess the aunt was legitimately through marriage, or was it through marriage? I don't know. Or was he through marriage? But they had been. Like uncles, but they were a generation older than my parents, but they were very close to us as a family, and but it was the connection was through my mother, and the, he was a VIP. He was a well-educated guy and a VIP at vice president, I guess he was, for at this Ivor Johnson Arms Cycle. He was an expert at gun design and what. And then when and he probably got the job for my father that he had lost, and then he had to move to another gun company in New Haven, Connecticut. I think it was Marlin Arms, and he got a top position there, and so he and his wife, and they may have been all the way still in Vermont during the Depression. They would come once a year with a, they had a house trailer, a nice one, you know, in those days, pretty expensive, and they had a big car like a LaSalle or something, that or Buick, I think it was, to tow it. And it was a nice one, you know. And they would come and park their car there and where we lived and then visit with us. But they didn't have to move in with us. And she was, I think he had married her when she was a showgirl or something. My mother didn't, and she was awfully, I don't know how to describe her. And from my perspective, she was fine, but she was kind, a nice person, and she took a real attraction to my sister, and you know, that, so they would invite her to go with them in the trailer. They could take it, they'd have room for maybe one to go. And so she liked to have my sister because she would, you know, being a woman, she could, you know, help her with her sewing and things like that, and learning and dressing and going. And my sister enjoyed going off with them.
So they did not have children of their own?
No, right. They didn't have any children of their own. Never did. And so then they'd go off with them. And then when we moved down to Connecticut, we went down and visited them in New Haven. And he was starting to have heart problems because he was living too richly. and they're both getting older then. So they must have been in their, probably in their 70s, early 70s. And I remember he was doing writing that related to, and my brother and I have tried to follow up and find anything that he was published, but he was, I'm pretty, quite sure he had a wonderful library, and he gave me books on early conservation, especially small game and non-game, migratory birds, before the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Mm-hmm. Book, I still have one or two of them. Hornaday was really pushing this. And he had been an ardent and hunter, and still he was especially bird hunter and with trained dogs. But he was also very much supportive of better game laws and prevention of overshooting and need for a bird treaty and the beginning he probably was influenced, knew of Aldo Leopold, but I didn't see any reference to that in his relationship. But and he had some influence in my father that as a result of that too on environmental management and good wildlife management. And then he died of a heart attack, and she went on for a few years. So we didn't know them too long. They were very kind and nice people. And, you know, during the Depression, they'd come and we didn't even get an allowance because our parents didn't have any cash to give you an allowance. Mm-hmm. They wanted to give us an allowance. And I think maybe if they gave it, it would be 5 cents, you know, or something like that, a week or so. But when my sister would go with them, they gave her 25 cents. We thought, holy mackerel, that's nirvana, my brother and I. But she accepted that she was enough older and a girl, so that she could do that.
She could get away with it.
Yeah.
And now you sort of implied that your mother was not too fond of, what were their names?
Arthur Percival Curtis. U-R-T-I-S.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot what her name was, but it was Curtis, too. Mm-hmm. And so my brother, who was an ardent hunter and sort of a redneck, but appreciative of these connections, too, that I'm talking about, he and I both independently tried to run down publications, because my mom was doing some typing. She was a good typist, so she was doing some typing of handwritten manuscript that A.P. Curtis was asking her to do and paying her for it. And but as an author in those days, I mean, he told mom that, just don't advertise what I'm writing about because it's not published. And, you know, so we never knew. And then I asked, I might have asked my mother once, while she was still alive and living with my sister in Florida and was dying from breast cancer, but about what she was typing. And she didn't really remember all that well, and maybe that was just deliberate that she didn't. She typed. A lot of people that do typing, and they of that nature, they just don't pay attention to what they're writing,
right?
Because they don't want to. There's no point in thinking about that.
Well, also, I mean, I think about if you're typing,
yeah,
you're just looking and typing.
That's
you're
right.
Not reading it. You're not
exactly.
Putting the words together. They're just letters.
And then my sister, I asked her, and she didn't have any clue either. And we couldn't. Of course, there's no manuscripts because this was strictly between her and him. But my brother and I both tried searches and good places to search, and we found out some many publications by A.P. Curtis, but we found that there was another A.P. Curtis. And that had to do with hunting and outdoor stuff, but we never have been successful. And after a while, we both gave up. I thought we could maybe run something down, but I haven't.
Hmm. But you sort of implied that your mother wasn't so fond of his wife.
Well, it was a combination of things. One, that she made a big deal out of, she was pretty ritzy when she is just married into it,
mm-hmm.
into the wealth that her husband had. And also when Betty would come back after they'd been on a trip, you know, Betty would say that she was put emphasis on the wrong things, you know, emphasis on the facade, whereas, see, that part of her daughter going out, but her daughter was already sharp enough and old enough to see that herself,
mm-hmm.
and realize that and still liked this woman and enjoyed that opportunity that they had to get it around and see the little bit of the country and what, which was a good experience for her. And basically, yes, and if I mention it now, my sister would be the same and say, yeah, that was good for her, and she appreciated their doing that. And, yeah, she would say, yeah, she was kind of a prissy woman, that her values were placed differently than us in the family, but she was understanding and tolerant.
Well, yeah, and as you say, your mother saw the benefit of letting your sister go with them and didn't stop that.
She did, I'm sure, and because my mother didn't, she understood this, but she probably also felt that she should have taken a stronger role in trying to curtail her husband from drinking too much alcohol and having these big rich dinners for guests and eating so much roast beef with a lot of fat and gravy and all that stuff. But at that time, you know, that was...
It's what people did.
What people did. Right. And he was, you know, he was past out hunting, you know, and hiking around the countryside. Then he was office bound and most of the time, and he was... had good pay and was doing a good job, and he had time to write on the side. That was, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to see, because I'm pretty sure the books that he had and there was reading and sometimes was marked up a bit. He was really focused on conservation and good management of wildlife. And opposed to, in those days, shooting hawks, you know, because all hawks are called chicken hawks.
Right. Well, and I don't want to go into it now because it's been a long evening, but we'll come back to talking about your influences with conservation and management and all that. So I'm sure we'll come back to talking about them. So don't think I'm forgetting.
I know you won't. I know you won't.
But
there's so much other stuff here that...
I don't want us to get too far off on that subject tonight.
Right.
That's a whole conversation in and of itself.
No, I understand that. And I appreciate that how you're approaching this.
Because I can tell that, you know, you've had... From the way you're talking, you know, you're growing up in Vermont that time, and your grandfather and your father, and then this man, Curtis, I can see how it's all building.
Yeah. One more point with regard to my mom, and her appreciation for the environment and aesthetics, landscape aesthetics, was one of the things she loved. Before the war, and then didn't have so much opportunity during the war because of gasoline rationing, was to go for if Dad wasn't working and was around and didn't have to work on the house or whatever, and sort of relaxing after it was usually a big Sunday dinner, roast beef, often, and you know, it'd be 1 o'clock you start, and then you'd have afternoon, and then, now this is all, we appreciated all this as kids, but then young people, especially young boys, you know, then we want to be free to go outside and play with buddies or do other things, or sometimes the weather, they wouldn't be doing that because the other families might be doing other things, and especially if they were church-oriented, you know, they wouldn't be available or whatever. At any rate, she'd like to go for a ride with Dad and anybody else in the car that we had, to look at the landscape, especially in the fall when the beautiful foliage and things like that. especially in the fall. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, in spring, liked it too, but she liked to be out on the ground when the things are growing, and that's when I would like to go with it. Well, on these Sunday afternoon rides, well, it was partly that I was the youngest one, and my sister and brother were often have arrangements with buddies on Sunday afternoon to do something. And you know, I could join them sometimes, but they would, and I knew that I was often, well, not my sister. She was so much older. She had her own things. And my brother and I, sometimes I would want to tag along with him and his buddies, but sometimes I was definitely tag along, and I knew that, but they were tolerant to let me tag along, but it wasn't all that great. And other times, then when Ned would ask her if she wanted to, if she wanted to go for a ride, and said, yeah, that, or she might suggest it even. And so, you know, it'd be for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and it'd stop some places and what. And not a lot of superhighways. It was all, you know, small mm-hmm. roads and beautiful fall colors and stuff. So I always wanted to go along, whereas the other kids, you know, especially my brother, it was kind of boring because they went so slow. He was into speed. So then as we grew up, and after the war, my brother and I were still at home, and on weekends, because I was off, and same with him, working or something, and weekends, and then my mom missed these riots, and for a while, my brother had a car, but I didn't, and she'd say to him, well, Dick, and I'd sure like to go for a ride. So he would say, yeah, okay, let's plan on it because I want to do something like this later in the afternoon or something. And so and by this time I frequently would have something else to do too. So at any rate, she had a problem with him because he wanted to go at high speed only on the superhighways that had just been built. And he said, you can see so much in a short period of time this way. And she would say, you know, I really appreciate you're taking the time to give me a ride, but I really don't enjoy driving at high speed. And you can't see things. You're going so fast. And the new highways, you don't have much view yet because they hadn't recovered from tearing up the countryside to build them. And then when he finally moved to a different place in Connecticut, up near the Massachusetts border, it was right to get from there to where we mom still lived. He could get there, and he had it timed exactly, you know, like going so many miles over the speed limit. He could get there in just maybe 26 minutes or something like that. And so if she needed a ride someplace, and he said, I can get to you in a hurry. When do you want to go?
Look at his watch.
I don't want to go at high speed.
So she always liked going slower.
Well, when they were driving, she had worked, Dad had trained her, and because it's always a passenger needs to be trained if they're going to assist the driver rather than you volunteer to assist, because you've got to be in total communication with someone who's assisting. So if you say, check to see if there's any traffic coming all from right. that direction, they want to take that really seriously. And there may be some way down the road, and they have to make the judgment and then say, yes, you can do it if you go right now or something like right. that. She worked well with her husband, her dad, our dad and her husband, because they had it worked out. And so I forgot what he called her. Her name was Norma, but he called her something else. But at any rate, he'd say, "Is it clear now?" She'd say, "Yep." But she realized it was her job when, if you're turning left on the highway and the cars are coming from the right, to be sure that it was clear. So he was very conscientious, and especially a lot of times cars didn't have signal lights in those days. Some might not, and some didn't work. So it worked out fine. But my brother, he was his own driver when he was driving.
He didn't need an assistant.
Right.
So your mother never learned to drive herself?
No. No. She took the buses and used the bus system. She never had to. Where we lived there, she just walked a block and a half to where you get the bus going into Hartford, and she worked in there. She'd take it back. She didn't really want to.
Yeah. My grandmother never learned to drive either.
She might have learned to drive at one time when earlier, but I don't think she ever wanted to learn to follow up on it.
Mm-hmm. So what did your father die from? He died so young.
It was a combination of a whole bunch of things. It was probably diabetes and a breakdown of the kidneys. I think it was primarily a kidney breakdown. While he was declining when in high school, he was still working right up to... He was still working when I went into the Navy right out of high school in 1945. He was still working, but he was having problems. And it was obvious that to her and him that it was going downhill really fast. And then he... Seems so when, that's true, because it was in high school that he was spending, and then before I finished high school, I think he stopped working, and he was going to the clinic frequently and had some bouts in the hospital. So he was declining, but it took place rather rapidly, and he would never imply that he was suffering in pain or anything to us kids. Mm-hmm. And he was always upbeat. And it was only after I got into the Navy and he died while I was in the Navy. And my mom's in letters, she was saying, he's having and his problems and they're getting much more serious, et cetera, et cetera. So it was obvious he was going downhill fast, and it couldn't be, at that time, it couldn't be corrected.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes sense, the connection between diabetes and kidney failure.
Yeah, right.
For sure. Your sister goes by the name Betty?
Elizabeth Betty. Betty's in family
right.
name, yeah.
And your brother Richard goes by Dick.
Dick, yeah.
Okay. Just so when you refer to them, make sure we're... I knew you were talking about the same people.
Yeah,
just
right.
So people know.
However... The grandfather, my mom's dad, was Richard Beverly, and his was called Dick, too.
Yeah. So, was there junior and senior, or?
Well, I think we use the term grandpa.
Grandpa, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and your father, Ferdinand, did he go by Ferdinand?
No. Sometimes Fred, but I think my mother called him Bud, B-U-D. Hmm. Yeah.
Because you have Ferdinand, it's a little bit of an exotic name.
Especially only one name, no middle name.
Yeah.
Ferdinand. But apparently it was not uncommon at that time in the 1800s. And probably there was some important king or something in Germany that was named Ferdinand.
I think there was a King Ferdinand, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, I have many more questions and lots of things to explore, but I'm thinking, should we take a break for tonight?
Sure, I'm ready.
Are you talked out?
I'm never talked out, but it's just as well that if we're talked out, I don't want to feel like I'm meeting a deadline to finish up.
We're not.
I know.
I'd
rather do these like we've done it and keep it casual, and then if something we can pick up next time.
Yeah, I just don't want to end in the middle of something.
Okay.
That's what.
Are we okay to end
now? So I don't know if it feels okay to me and it feels okay to you.
Feels definitely good to me, yeah.
Okay.